Imagine a piece of land, desolate and wild. Somewhere in this vast expanse, a tiny group of primeval humans has taken up residence. A tribal settlement is built. The village is invented. After a million years of hunting, farming begins. And with our new affluence, the villages grow into towns. By Roman times, these towns are already magnificent in their scale and in their architecture. But they continue to grow. Nothing can stop them now. 1,000 years on, a large medieval city has sprung up. Later, the boundaries of the now vast settlement spread as far as the eye can see. In evolutionary terms, the human animal has gone from mud hut to skyscraper in the mere twinkling of an eye. There have been massive cultural advances, but no time at all for biological changes. In certain ways, our great cities are a paradise on Earth compared with our primeval settlements. They give us creature comforts and freedoms of many kinds. But there's always been a price to pay. After many years spent living in London, where I'd written The Naked Ape, I moved in the late 1960s to a village on the small Mediterranean island of Malta. From here, I was able to look back at the urban environment and view it dispassionately. It was here, in the peace and quiet of a Maltese garden, that I decided to write a sequel to The Naked Ape. I wanted to have a look at the way in which man, the primeval hunter, become transformed into man, the modern city dweller. What had happened to all those ancient primitive urges, the need for spaces, for territories, for hunting grounds, now that he was crushed into tiny cells inside these great cities? Some people, of course, call the city a concrete jungle. But jungles aren't like that. Animals in jungles aren't overcrowded. And overcrowding is the central problem of modern city life. If you want to look for crowded animals, you have to look in a zoo. And then it occurred to me, the city is not a concrete jungle, it's a human zoo. How do we cope with the crush and confusion of our cramped city environment? How has it affected our tribal behaviour, our social relations, our aggression, and our need for territory? How do we organise our lives in the artificial world of the human zoo? Somehow we manage to interlock our movements with those of the thousands who surround us in the great metropolis. The metropolis in which is trapped not some wild-eyed victim of a hunt, but the human hunter himself. Inevitably, with such unnaturally crowded conditions, even the amazing adaptability of the human animal sometimes falters. The system breaks down and violence erupts. What is surprising about these scenes is that they're so rare. After all, the human animal evolved over a million years to live not like this, but in small tribal groups of no more than 150 individuals. In the villages of the Dogon tribe in West Africa, it's still possible to get a glimpse of this earlier way of life. The key feature of this lifestyle is that there are no strangers present. The communities here have retained their primeval group size of 150. As a result, everyone knows everyone else.
This makes people feel secure, but it can also lead to alarmingly elaborate and endlessly repeated greeting ceremonies. Everyone has to be acknowledged as the villagers go about their daily routine. Because all Dogon tribespeople are so aware of everyone else in their society, they're rarely solitary. When they move from place to place inside the village, they prefer to travel in small groups rather than singly. For the modern city dweller, the major difference is that he's now surrounded by countless strangers. He can't possibly know them all personally, and he can't greet them all, or he'd never complete a journey. So he avoids their gaze, pretending they're not there. Although it's a most unnatural thing for a human to do, he strides through their midst as though they're trees in a forest. When the tribesman leaves his tribe behind and moves to the big city, he faces a dramatic new problem. This is the phone book of Los Angeles. There are literally millions of names in it. And Los Angeles has already grown to be half the size of Belgium. So the human tribesman can't possibly make all these people members of his own tribe. So what does he do? The answer is here, in his personal address book. This is his tribe. It contains the names of his family and friends, his relatives and his colleagues. This is his personal tribe. So it's wrong to think of the citizen as a human ant in a great human anthill. The city is not an amorphous mass. It's a vast interlocking network of tribes, all interwoven together. Unfortunately for the modern citizen, he can't always remain in the bosom of his own tribe. He must frequently strike out into alien territory. It's then that, to protect himself from social overkill, he's forced to turn all these strangers into trees in a forest. So, at times like this, it's not surprising that he treats a collapsed body as no more than a fallen log and walks past it. By the simple device of asking someone to feign a collapse and lie still on the ground, I was able to establish that in a big city street, a human figure, apparently in need of urgent attention, can remain unattended for a very long time indeed. It's not that these city dwellers are uncaring. It's that in the city, it's simply impossible to react emotionally to everyone as if they belong to your own tribe. When the same body lay in a village street, rescue was immediately at hand. Interestingly, it came from the local inhabitants, the true villagers, not from the visiting tourists. So one of the changes in behaviour that's taken place during our rise from tribe to super tribe is a dramatic reduction in this kind of personal cooperative behaviour. In the city, strangers are treated almost as though they belong to another species. This has led to something that's extremely rare among villagers, to the phenomenon of theft. The helping hand in the city is not always what it seems. The urban thief treats his target not as a potential friend, but as a member of a rival tribe. With the practiced skill of a craftsman, he delicately lifts the gold bracelet from his victim's wrist. This trend starts young. A hidden camera enables us to watch this small gang of pickpockets operating skillfully in a big department store. They cooperate with one another and work as a group, but feel nothing for their victim, who again is unknown to them personally. Superstores are even more impersonal than strangers. And for these ram raiders, the act of thieving becomes an exciting game, played out by urban tribesmen for whom crime has become a tribal way of life. Because it's so important to demonstrate some kind of tribal membership, to set the individual apart from the teeming masses, the modern tribesman adopts a wide variety of tribal uniforms that display his particular allegiance. The black leather of these Hell's Angels and the striped blazers at Henley Regatta are instantly recognisable as tribal badges. If the tribesman displays the right badges, he labels himself to the world as a member of one particular group. Sharing his costume, his manners, his form of speech and his colours with those around him, he feels strengthened by the shared display. It excludes non-members and gives him a sense of tribal identity and power. Even when the tribal signals are rather mild, sharing the same display makes members of the group feel more confident, more at ease. As a way of forging the tribal bond, some groups demand an initiation ceremony. This ancient tradition survives today even in the most advanced cultures. Obediently, these new recruits to a Japanese electronics company chant the song of their new tribe. In a shared ordeal, they're introduced to the tribal elders, who are suitably elevated on a special platform. And in unison, they display their newly acquired subservience to the might of the company.
When I get to three, do it.
Here in Los Angeles, a group of female gang members from one of the feared city gangs is also initiating a new recruit. The function of this tribal ordeal is precisely the same. But the form it takes is very different.
10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, kicker, 24, kicker, 30, kicker, slug in the face, 29, 30.
After enduring 30 seconds of physical abuse, she's accepted as a fully fledged member of the gang.
That's right. How do you feel, Holmes?
Great.
Dumb, I'm down and crazy.
Once a tribal group has been established, it must repeatedly display its existence. Tribal badges are not enough. Shared rituals must be performed. Members of the tribe must indulge in extravagantly unique activities that conspicuously set them apart from other tribes. New tribes invent their own unique language of rituals with amazing speed.
Pass the brass monkey, look!
Others, with age-old traditions like these Freemasons, frequently develop rituals that are staggeringly elaborate and, to the outsider, frankly bizarre. Whatever the specific reasons given for all these different tribal rituals, they all have the same underlying significance, namely, that they repeatedly reinforce the tribesman's sense of tribal belonging. And this happens all over the world in a thousand different ways, usually with synchronized movements and music that increase that feeling of tribal sharing. Thank you. This shared rhythmic quality of tribal rituals breaks down at moments of high intensity. Then the individual tribesman forgets his companions and becomes lost in the ecstasy or the agony of the moment. But at less intense moments, even the largest of tribes manages, by performing simple rhythmic actions, to enjoy the experience of shared involvement. This orderly scene is the cheerful face of tribalism that survives even when the tribe becomes swollen into a vast super tribe. Flip the coin, and there's a stark contrast. This tribe of Korean students has come into violent conflict with a tribe of Korean police. The members of each group are acting in support of their companions, and they're driven on by their sense of loyalty. Violence can even break out in supposedly restrained groups, such as rival political parties, as here in the Japanese parliament. When disputes erupt, it's much more common to observe some kind of avoiding action. This man, as soon as he's seriously threatened, will lie down and adopt a submissive posture that will successfully switch off the attack. Visual and vocal threat displays can resolve disagreements without the spilling of blood. In real fighting, even the winner may be injured, and all animals, not just humans, go to great lengths to avoid serious physical attacks. So most disputes are settled by threat and counter-threat, rather than by actual fighting. One way in which violent emotions can find a bloodless outlet is through what's called redirected aggression. Here, the anger is vented on inanimate objects instead of on human rivals. With these joyriders, the victims are vehicles rather than people. One of the most spectacular examples of stylized aggression is an event called the Palio, which takes place twice a year in Siena. At first sight, one can be forgiven for imagining that a battle is about to be fought between the main tribes of the city. The occasion has all the trappings of ancient warfare, with flag waving, military uniforms, and the beating of drums. The colours of the different tribes are worn by individuals all over the city, heightening the intensity of the occasion. But this is to be a fight by proxy. The true warriors here are not these men. The warriors of the Palio are not human, they're equine. This is to be a battle between horses, and uniquely, they're permitted to enter the churches to be blessed before the ordeal begins. The aggression of the young men in the city reaches a vocal climax before the final act of the event begins.
The
Each horse represents one of the ancient families of Siena and carries their colours. For these bareback jockeys, the race has no rules. They can use their whips on one another as well as on their mounts. This is a savage contest for both horse and rider, and few of these riders will complete the course. Indeed, unlike any other horse race, it's the first horse past the post that wins, with or without a rider on its back. After days of preparation, the race takes only 90 seconds, but during that brief time, the whole of Siena is focused on the intense drama and its outcome. This highly stylized ritual of tribal rivalry drains so much aggression from the population that it appears to reduce the amount of violence in the city throughout the whole year. And it's certainly true that Siena has one of the lowest crime rates of any European city. That, then, is human tribal behavior. But how do we organize ourselves within each tribe?
Considering how complicated modern urban society is, it's remarkable that people aren't more aggressive than they are. For most people, an average day is really very friendly and amicable. How is this managed? Well, to some extent, it's because we stay with people like ourselves. We have a group of people with whom we feel at ease. We feel comfortable with our friends and with people who are similar to us. So what happens is that society organizes itself into a number of levels, each level feeling at home with its own kind. The British pub is a good example of this. The bars each have different names. There's the lounge bar, the smoking room, and further down there, the public bar. And people gather in the bar where their friends are, where they feel that they're in the right social grouping. And that reduces friction. And that, of course, is the basis of the social hierarchy.
This gathering of senior Maasai in East Africa demonstrates social levels rather neatly. They arrange themselves in three rows: higher status at the front, middle status in the center, and lower status at the back. In the front row sit the tribal elders. The chief himself displays his rank by his ebony staff. And all the elders show off their fly whisks and their elongated, decorated ears. In the second row, the junior elders have their elongated ears wrapped up in readiness for the day when they'll graduate to the front row. And in the third row sit the warriors, who display their rank by holding erect their sharp spears. Each culture has its own special forms of status display, and it's not always easy for outsiders to anticipate the subtle rules that are in operation in any particular case. If we were invited to this Japanese boardroom, we might easily sit in the wrong chair. Every position is carefully worked out, the precise rank of each executive being defined by his distance from the managing director. This boardroom is a status minefield. If we were served with tea, we might unwisely take a sip straight away. But in this delicately structured world, we'd be committing a social gaffe. The managing director must drink first. Then each of his executives may drink in turn according to their relative seniority. In this streamlined, high-tech world, it's necessary to become skilled at the nuances of correct behavior and status etiquette. Watching body language can give us a special insight into status relations. Here, the manager on the right is unconsciously mimicked in almost every action he makes by the junior executive. Cheek scratch, cheek scratch. Arms fold, arms fold. Nose wipe, nose wipe. Head nod, head nod. And when the senior man smokes a cigarette, the junior does his best, putting his empty fingers to his lips. One of the most basic forms of high status display is increased size. For the reigning monarch, this is achieved by placing her on a raised platform and providing her with tall headgear. In her case, the headgear is a crown. For the archbishop, it's a mitre. This idea of height and status going together is very basic to human behaviour, and indeed to the behaviour of many other animals. If the high-status individual is very small, like this Kumari virgin in a Nepalese religious ceremony, then the throne on which she sits must be raised up even more than usual to compensate for her diminutive figure and to place her in an appropriately elevated position. In this way, the tiny 9-year-old girl, in her tall crown and golden robes, suddenly becomes transformed into a regal, queenly figure. Local status displays are so familiar to the people involved that it's often assumed they can be understood universally, but this is not the case.
If a tribesman from another land were to view this scene, he could be forgiven for making a mistake about the status of the individuals involved. Looking down there, he would perhaps assume that the individuals in the brightly coloured costumes sitting on the horses are the dominant members of this particular group. But, of course, he'd be making a mistake. He wouldn't realise that the colours they're wearing belong to the owners of the horses and not to them.
On closer scrutiny, he might spot that when the brightly dressed jockey meets the plainly dressed figure in the ring, he politely touches his cap, revealing the true status relationship between the two. Again, the high status of this figure in blue is revealed when the jockey on the horse touches his cap as he passes her. In earlier days, high status demanded elaborate costumes. But today, thanks to the media, a famous face is alone enough to indicate elevated rank. By deliberately wearing casual clothing, even on a special occasion, the high status individual says, with mock humble arrogance, "I don't need the trappings. I'm big enough without them." In the eyes of Allah, all Muslims are equal. This poses a problem for the very high-status king of Morocco. During the inauguration of a new mosque in Casablanca, he's obliged to wear the traditional djellaba of the Moroccan people. How do we know, then, that he is of much higher rank than the others present at the ceremony? Well, he's set further back, away from the main assembly, and he's raised ever so slightly on a shallow platform of cushions. Not enough to insult the deity, but just enough to make him different from his fellow worshippers. Even more revealing is the behaviour of other people when approaching him. They bow so low that as they talk to him, they literally have to look up to him. So, in special circumstances, high status can be displayed passively merely through the actions of subordinates. It's clear that just as increased height can raise status, so body lowering can reduce it. In this Zen Buddhist monastery, everybody bows deeply to the Buddha. But when the monks bow to one another, their relative degree of body lowering reveals their respective ranks, with the junior monks bowing further than the senior one, who also incidentally uses special clothing signals to underline his high status. Occasionally, a status display is performed that includes an unusual element. This Maasai bride not only has to lower her eyes, which is a common form of subordination, but is also made to wear excrement on her shaven head as an additional way of emphasizing her low status in the ceremony. To fully appreciate the origins of all these various forms of body lowering, we only have to observe what happens when people are seriously threatened with death or injury. To reduce the risk of brutal assault, these rioting Bangkok students frantically prostrate themselves, trying to make their bodies as small as possible. Here lie, in both senses of the word, the raw origins of human submissive actions. Like other animals, big to us means powerful. It's as basic and primitive as that. And when I look at this small village, I realize that if I knew nothing about the inhabitants, I would imagine that the dominant individual there lived in that huge building in the middle, surrounded by a lot of subordinates. And of course, that is indeed the case. It's just that in our species, uniquely, the dominant member of the group is present only in spirit. When people first discovered God, the deity quickly acquired a role of major importance to human society. Treated as the dominant individual with all the appropriate gestures of subordination, the awesome power of the god figure commanded a deep respect. Although this respect was exploited by holy men who set themselves up as God's agents, it also had the effect of making people within groups much more cooperative. In this way, organized religion became the ultimate status strategy, producing subordination displays of a more extreme kind than can be found in any other sphere of human activity. An extraordinary example of this is displayed by this pilgrim visiting the Labrung Monastery in Tibet. He has to prostrate himself on the ground every step of his journey, which may be hundreds of miles from his home. Setting up a social hierarchy is one of the two ways in which we organize our human tribes. The second is establishing a territory. Whereas status is concerned with who you are, territory is concerned with where you are. In being territorial, we differ from most other primates. This is because, as primeval hunters, our ancestors needed a place to return to with the spoils of the chase. We had to have a home base, and that home base had to be defended. We feel compelled to set up territorial signs, indicating that this is an occupied area. In this way, we hope to reduce the need to actively defend our homes. We trust people to respect our space if we make the boundaries clear enough. We also treat our vehicles as mobile territories, and when these are threatened, defend them with an amazing primeval passion.
Open the door.
In addition to a family territory, each of us has a personal territory. In a large office, it may be no more than a desk area. But once again, we try to label it as our own personal property. These may look like childish toys, but in reality, they're territorial markers, declaiming that this is my desk, keep off.
Just how powerful are territorial markers? Let's try an experiment. We'll put a coat on a chair over there and see how long it manages to keep people from sitting on that particular chair.
What follows is 2 hours compressed to 45 seconds. As with other species, our personal space is like an invisible territorial shield that surrounds us wherever we go and that distances us one from another. Wherever you look, you can see bodies arranged at regular intervals, as though obeying some unwritten spatial law. In today's world, personal space is often at a premium. This is a capsule hotel in Tokyo, where each guest must endure a bedroom little bigger than that ultimate personal territory, the coffin. In stark contrast is this Las Vegas hotel suite, where the high status of high rollers demands the biggest apartment in the world. Size is not only important in status relations, it's also a common weapon of territorial display. Wherever we go, we like to establish temporary territories. Without a well-defined space, we feel lost.
I like to be at the back, small and petite.
So we're forever setting out our territorial markers and recreating familiar surroundings. As here, where imaginary dining rooms are magically conjured up in the middle of a field full of cars. Sometimes we seem to indulge in activities that could be called territory for territory's sake. Throughout Japan, when the cherry blossom is about to fall, people leave their homes and carry rough and ready territorial markers with them to establish and defend a small patch of ground in the middle of public parks. The cherry blossom is really only an excuse for an orgy of civilized territorialism. Each group enjoys the sensation of being inside their little nest, even though it's only a simple flat covering on the ground. There they sit beneath the trees for hour after hour, eating and drinking and talking and enjoying the view. They usually respect one another's territorial markers and rarely intrude on one another's delineated spaces. Occasionally there are brief disputes like this one because of the strictly territorial conventions, but they're extremely rare and quickly settled. Once they're all well installed, they celebrate with songs and dances and a warm sense of belonging to a territorial group. I The cherry blossom viewing happens only once a year. When it's over, the small group territories will be dismantled and the park will return to normal. Some other group territories are more permanent. In cities where gangs of young males have created a rebellious subculture, there's often a return to a primitive and savage form of tribal territory. Each gang restricts its activities to a small, clearly defined section of the city, and tribal discipline is severe.
Hey, sit, man. What are you going to fight that for?
Here in the very centre of gangland in Los Angeles, walls and buildings are covered with graffiti. Everywhere you look, there are visual signs. Now, this is because each gang has its own particular territory, which has to be defended, and not only defended, but also displayed to the rivals, saying, this is our patch. If we were wolves or tigers, we'd do it by scent marking, but because we're humans, we do it visually. And almost every area here that can be painted on has been painted on. Amongst the markings, there are specific signs saying, this is our territory.
To some people, this is pure vandalism, but to the gang members themselves, it's a private language of great significance. Although these gangs have stepped outside official society, they're still bound by rigid rules of their own making. They must learn the gang hand signs, wear appropriate clothing, and decorate themselves with body tattoos.
They're not done, though.
There were over 800 gangland killings last year, and gang members are always on their guard for possible attacks from rivals. Even when, to outsiders, they appear to be almost sleepily relaxed.
Because graffiti are such important territorial markers, the most dangerous thing you can do in gangland is to go around and obliterate somebody else's graffiti. And that's exactly what's happening at the moment over there. A group of graffiti artists is working over the top of some specific gang signs, and if those gangs find out what's happening, then there will be shooting.
Gang members now treat the frequent gunfights as a routine part of daily life. The human animal is a compulsively tribal, compulsively territorial species. If the leaders of modern society don't offer acceptable forms of tribalism and territorial display, then unacceptable ones will explode in their faces. Beyond personal territory, beyond family territory, even beyond tribal territory, there's another level of social organization. And that, of course, is national territory. If you look around the streets of a city like New York, you can see the signs, the emblems, the symbols, the colors, and the flags that reflect the persistence of national loyalties. When a large national gathering is assembled in one place to cry out its territorial chants, the effect is intensely emotional for those taking part, and equally threatening to those who do not belong. In fact, to other national groups, these threat displays can be deeply offensive, as they were, of course, originally intended to be. So what's the future of the human zoo? As we've seen, it contains an overcrowded mass of human animals, animals that evolved to live in tiny, scattered tribes. So how on earth can they enjoy a lifetime in ramshackle slums or in huge, impersonal tower blocks? We already know from studies of other animals that serious overcrowding causes acute stress, and that this stress can damage the body's immune system. This same process applies to the human animal. And unless we slow down our population growth, further overcrowding may well unleash waves of disease and epidemic. 30 years ago, there were a mere 3,000 million people alive in the world. Today, that figure has nearly doubled. What this means for many city dwellers is daily chaos and congestion. So why do we want to live in the city? Why don't we all return to a simple tribal existence, to a village like this? There's plenty of space here and a serenely untroubled atmosphere. Living here, we could escape the stress, the pollution and the violence of the city. So why do we stay? The answer is personal freedom and a sensation that in the city, anything is possible. The ever-changing complexity of the city excites us. If we use it well, the city can become a dazzling stimulation palace in whose corridors our imagination can be let loose, our creativity unleashed. At its worst, it can send us to an early grave. At its best, it can send us to the moon. So, the city of the future can either be a stress-ridden human zoo or an exciting human game park. The choice is up to us.